Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, a crash has closed I-10 eastbound. It's about midway between Phoenix and Casa Grande. ADOT says the closure is at milepost 179. No estimated time to reopen those eastbound lanes. Westbound, the westbound side is unaffected. Again, I-10 eastbound closed just about midway between Phoenix and Casa Grande at milepost 179. Valley forecast for the rest of the day, calling for sunny skies. Cloudy skies, though, for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. Slight chance of rain tomorrow, a high of 69. 63 for a high on Saturday, still with a slight chance of rain. It's sunny right now in Phoenix, 73 degrees at KJZZ. The Arizona Supreme Court this morning denied a request to block a new higher minimum wage from taking effect on Sunday. Voters approved Proposition 206 in November. It'll raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour on New Year's Day, eventually reaching $12 an hour by 2020. The measure also requires employers to provide their workers with at least 3 days of paid sick leave each year. Prop 206 organizer Tomas Robles says he was confident the law would be allowed to take effect.
Well, we wrote the proposition to make sure that we were well within the scope of the law and make sure that it was airtight in terms of ensuring that we would not be out of regulation.
But critics of the higher minimum wage, including the Arizona Chamber of Commerce, maintain the measure is unconstitutional. Among their arguments, Prop 206 violates the requirement of voter-approved spending to identify where that money will come from. Arizona's Medicaid program plans to boost payments as part of its contracts, and Glenn Hammer, president of the Arizona Chamber, doesn't buy the argument that the measure does not require state agencies to pay more.
This is splitting hairs. They have to do it, or the system could suffer greatly. And providers providing necessary care to the indigent and those most in need of health care could go out of business. They have to do it.
For more on what today's decision means, both for this weekend and beyond, I'm joined by Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, what exactly did the court say?
Well, the justices themselves simply told the foes to go away and don't darken our door. I know that's being a little flip about it, but they said, look, there's a hearing set for February on the full-blown issue of the injunction. We are not going to issue an emergency stay. Now, they did not explain their logic, but understand that in Arizona, in order to get an injunction, much less an emergency stay, you have to prove a number of things, including who has the hardship, and whether you're likely to succeed at the end. Now, Judge Daniel Kiley, in his ruling last week, said, look, you know, maybe there's some hardship on the state, but there's really a hardship on the 700,000 people who are expecting a pay raise on January 1st. The other part of it deals with that issue of likelihood of success. And what Judge Kiley said, and what the Supreme Court apparently ratified today, is that we don't think that after all is said and done, and all your claims about somehow the state's going to have to spend more money and that's an unconstitutional mandate, we don't necessarily think you're going to win that case.
So it seems as though the court is essentially saying, we think this minimum wage is within the bounds of the Constitution. We don't see a point in stopping it now. Maybe we'll stop it after the hearing, but probably not.
Well, here's the other thing that happens. When Attorney Brett Johnson for the chamber asked the court right now for the stay, he said, let's maintain the status quo. Let's just leave everything the way they are. People are earning $805 now. They'll earn $805 or really $815, you know, come January 1st. So nothing will change. So let's maintain the status quo. Here's the problem that the chamber now has. By February, the status quo will be 700,000 people making at least $10 an hour who are not. And that presents a real uphill burden for the chamber to say, now we should enjoin the law, bring everyone back to $805 an hour while we go through a full-blown trial on the merits. And that really is a legal hurdle that may be too much for the chamber to overcome.
This morning's ruling was issued by the five justices who had been on the Supreme Court before the two new ones were sworn in earlier this month. In February, though, the full seven-justice complement will hear the case. Does that seem like it will change the potential outcome any?
Well, obviously, they will have had the benefit of full briefings on this thing, and not only including the current five, but the two new ones. But the reason I'm hesitant to suggest it will change anything is, A, in today's order, all five of the justices apparently signed on in denying the emergency relief. In other words, we did not have an order saying these four justices said we're denying the injunction, but the fifth justice would have granted it. So you've got five right there. Here's the other piece of it. The two new justices taking office, one of them is John Lopez, who currently works or has worked for the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office, in fact, is a party to the lawsuit and has been defending the legality of what voters approve. That would suggest that Mr. Lopez might conflict himself out, so he would not be in a position to vote for or against it. So you may have a six-justice court deciding this. It's hard to, you know, wager a lot of money on what you think the courts will do, but you know, this is an uphill burden on the proponents in terms of, again, changing the status quo and in terms of convincing three or four justices to say, nah, we don't think that what voters approved is constitutional. And that goes to the other piece of it. In general, one of the issues on injunction is the question of public policy. And the argument by the Attorney General's office has been the public policy of the state is that we have a constitutional initiative process, and we should, when possible, give deference to the will of the voters to decide what they want. And the voters decided this is what they want.
That's Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
The federal government is sending more than $25 million to Maricopa County to help with its homelessness problem. The grant from the Department of Housing and Urban Development will support services and programs that provide housing for people and families experiencing homelessness. For more on this, I'm joined by Amy Schwabenländer. She's Vice President of Community Impact at Valley of the Sun United Way and co-chair of the Maricopa Regional Continuum of Care Board. That's the group that'll get the $25.4 million. And Amy, how impactful will this money be in the region?
The HUD dollars through this funding source are tremendously impactful. They support 42 programs that are mostly housing focused, meaning they're housing for formerly chronically homeless individuals and families that now have a permanent place to call home. And the dollars support a rapid rehousing intervention, which is a one-time housing assistance that really ends someone's homelessness. We couldn't support the housing programs here in Maricopa County without the HUD support.
Is this money going to putting up new affordable housing units? Is it going to helping get people who don't have a home into an existing unit?
These dollars support housing programs that have typically been in existence for a while. There is one new project being funded this year in this round of funding that the dollars would support people moving into scattered site apartments. This is a HUD funding source called McKinney-Vento that's renewable every year. Our community has been a pretty strong performer in this process in receiving these dollars, which is why we get excited when the projects are renewed, because it means we can keep people housed.
How big of a dent do you think that this money will put into the Valley's homeless population?
Well, again, it really helps people stay housed that were formerly chronically homeless, meaning they were long-time homeless, and they rely on permanent supportive housing to keep them housed. In the rapid rehousing, these dollars help definitely with a population that falls into homelessness each year and will help hundreds of individuals and families end their homelessness.
So it sounds almost like this money is helping folks stay in a home. So in a sense, it's almost helping keep the problem from getting worse, as opposed to really like trying to make a tremendous dent in getting folks who are currently homeless into a home.
Correct. This HUD funding source does not fund emergency shelter. HUD in this funding stream really wants to support housing programs that end homelessness and keep people housed.
How big of a problem is homelessness right now in Maricopa County?
What we've seen over the last several years is that our numbers are remaining almost flat, with about 6,000 people experiencing homelessness on any given night in Maricopa County.
Is that considered good that the numbers are staying where they are? They're not going down, but they're also not going up.
Given what we see happening in other communities across the country where their numbers are going up, I would say that it's a good sign that we can keep things generally about flat. Of course, for those individuals, it's not good, and we would like everyone to have a safe place to live.
Relative to other cities and other metro areas, you know, roughly the same size as Phoenix and the Valley, is 6,000 a lot of homeless residents?
It's too many. Percentage-wise, based on population, it puts us in, you know, a not-so-great position across the country. We're definitely not having the worst issue in the country. We're not the best. And locally, in our continuum of care and with our jurisdictional leaders, we're really focused on what's happening here and how do we prevent and end more homelessness.
Amy Schwabenlender is Vice President of Community Impact for the Valley of the Sun United Way and co-chair of the Maricopa Regional Continuum of Care Board. We are talking about the more than $25 million grant that group recently got from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance in Arizona is one of the largest food banks in the U.S. It takes in 2.5 million pounds of food every year through food drives. About 40% of that supply comes in during November and December. So what did Arizonans give to St. Mary's this year? The show's Annika Klein looked through some boxes to find out.
This is what they call the reclamation room. It's where donated food starts out on its journey at the food bank.
We have literally hundreds of thousands of pounds of food here that need to be sorted.
Jerry Brown walks over to one of the cardboard bulk boxes sitting on wooden pallets. This one was stationed outside of a Goodwill and still needs to be sorted.
I'm looking at this right here. This bag of beans is maybe a third full and wide open. That's not something that we can use.
Near the beans is a bag of pasta that was opened and then rewrapped in another plastic bag. Both will have to be tossed. Now, to be clear, Brown says the 200,000 pounds of food they get from the Goodwill boxes alone is really appreciated. It's just they end up tossing about 60,000 pounds of it every year.
They're cleaning out their closets so they can give clothes and toys and things like that to Goodwill. They're cleaning out their refrigerators at the same time, maybe not always looking as close.
Volunteers will be looking closely, taking many hours to go through all this food. And what's kept will be sorted by food group. In the next room, the boxes are a lot neater, more like the grocery store than the contents of someone's pantry. There's a box for canned fruit, a pallet for rice.
When people ask us what is it that we don't need, things like ramen noodles are things that, you know, it was great when you were a college kid to cook a quick meal and to get you through a study session, but they really don't have any nutritional value.
But sure enough, there are a couple boxes of ramen noodles right at our feet. And across the room is the Holy Grail, from the way Brown talks it up. Peanut butter. If ramen is the food bank's rainy day fallback, peanut butter is its sunshine. And there's never enough of it. Brown suspects it has to do with the quantity over quality conundrum.
If your child's having a food drive at school and you want to give them a full bag, you'll tend to go to the fruits and vegetables section where it's maybe 50 cents a can or something like that, and you'll buy 10 cans of vegetables.
But he says a few jars of peanut butter will stretch further, even if it doesn't look as impressive in the food drive box. On a long conveyor belt, cans and jars and bags of food that have passed the test are reaching the end of their journey. Volunteers put the food into boxes that will go to individual families.
Some green beans, some potatoes, some corn or...
Jason Groon is a Phoenix police officer, but today he's volunteering with some elementary students on the assembly line.
So they get all the food groups pretty much covered. They get their basic nutrients, they get food that a lot of people just take for granted.
Even though that reclamation room is like a never-ending treasure hunt for usable food, the end result is stacks and stacks of neatly packed boxes that will find a good home. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
You're listening to The Show. Glad to have you here. With The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick. I'm Mark Brody. President Obama designated two new national monuments yesterday, protecting 1.65 million acres of land. Bears Ears Butte is in Utah, Gold Butte is in southern Nevada, and the president made the move using the 1906 Antiquities Act.
President Obama is trying to preserve his green legacy from an incoming Trump administration that has promised to undo environmental regulations. Conservation groups and Native American tribes applauded Obama's move, but some elected officials in both states were vehemently opposed to both of the monuments. Kristen Brangle is the Vice President for Government Affairs at the National Parks Conservation Association, and she joins me now. Kristen, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Well, both Bears Ears Buttes and Gold Butte have been the subject of long-running disputes in Nevada and Utah over land use. Describe these two places and sort of what the controversies have been like.
They're both exceptional places. They're beautiful. They are the typical Western red rock lands that you see in movies and in pictures, and they're extremely threatened by mining and looting and other activities that happen out there. So essentially, we have millions of acres like this. These are unique. These are completely surrounded by national parks, Canyonlands National Park, Arches National Park, and in Nevada, Lake Mead and the Grand Canyon. And they're controversial simply because, you know, folks want to continue to graze and do certain activities, which they'll be able to continue under this monument proclamation that they're both existing under. So it's kind of disappointing when folks are negative about them, because they're incredible areas and the public will really enjoy them even more now.
So when a national monument like this is designated, that means things like mining can't continue, but surface activities, grazing, things that are renewable can continue?
Correct. And under the proclamation that President Obama signed for both monuments, grazing can continue. And that's one of the major activities out there. There really isn't as much oil and gas. And even the oil and gas leases that are there are going to be grandfathered in. So there's no real threat to those activities.
So what do you see President Obama doing here when you sort of step back from these two territories that have been designated monuments? Is this a defense of an environmental legacy that has been disappointing to some? What do you think he's doing?
President Obama, in his 8 years in office, has protected some of the greatest places in the country that were unprotected before he came into office. So he's kind of doing what others haven't done in the past and protecting more wonderful places, rock, art, artifacts, than any other president has been able to designate before him.
Well, if President Obama can designate these monuments under the Antiquities Act, could possibly President Trump turn around and undesignate them?
No, he can't. The Antiquities Act is written in a way to actively protect areas, but not to undo protection for areas. So he has absolutely no authority to undo a monument. Congress could, but not another president. And it's never been done before.
So now that Harry Reid, who was a huge advocate of Gold Butte in Nevada, I mean, I can tell you that he talked about it all the time. Harry Reid won't be in the Senate after January 2nd. A Republican Congress could turn around if they mustered the votes and undo these monument designations.
Undoing any type of protection like a national monument or a national park is something that no Congress wants to be known for doing. These are special places. People cherish these places. They love them. Congress would get an incredibly even worse reputation than they already have if they started to dismantle places of high public value that people love and appreciate, like national monuments and national parks.
Utah and Nevada each have a new national monument designated by President Obama on his way out of the White House, Bears Ears Buttes and Gold Butte. Kristen Brangle, Vice President of Governmental Affairs at National Parks Conservation Association. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. There are obviously many beautiful vistas across Arizona as well, many animals that live along those buttes and rivers, and now there's one more. An invasive snake has been found in Yuma waters. Officials are concerned because the snakes could pose a threat to local species and alter the Colorado River ecosystem. Maya Springhawk Robnett of the Arizona Science Desk reports for KJZZ.
So where we're heading right now is north of Yuma on Laguna Dam Road. We're going to a lake called Mitri Lake.
Richard Myers is investigating the arrival of the southern banded water snake at Mitri Lake and other Colorado River waters in the Yuma area. On a humid Friday afternoon, Myers, an Arizona Game and Fish Wildlife Manager, drives to the lake where the snakes have been spotted most frequently. The invasive snake can grow up to 3 feet long. It sports thick bands of black and faint bands of orange, but you're not likely to see one. As Myers stands in a thick of cattail reeds, he says they like to hide.
But sometimes, like, if they're going after an amphibian, a frog or something, sometimes they will be on the edge of the water, and so they probably hunt at night when these things are out doing their thing, so they're probably skirting the shoreline, maybe at dusk, but during the day, they're kind of like any animal, they're getting back in refuge a little bit, so.
The snakes like Mitre Lake because, with cattails and stagnant water, it is similar to the Florida swamps where the snakes are native. The animals are also drawn to the area due to the abundance of invertebrates, amphibians, and fish. They are not venomous, but Arizona Game and Fish is concerned about the snake's impact on other species. They compete with and could potentially wipe out native species, such as the protected giant garter snake. Sitting in his truck, Myers explains that the snakes are already a problem in California, but he's not sure how they got into this area.
However it came in, whatever means it came in, as if it was somebody's pet, it wasn't just a pet, it was probably more than one. So it would take two, obviously, to successfully breed, which they have done. We have over 20 now collected, so obviously there was more than the initial one that was reported.
Arizona Game and Fish is monitoring the snakes and their spread. Lynn Peast is the terrestrial wildlife biologist for the Yuma office.
We probably have thousands at this point, based on how many we were able to collect.
Peast, who has been with the department for 31 years, says the snakes might have started with just two, but they've quickly reproduced. He says another concern is how far the animals have spread geographically.
We've pretty well documented where they occur around Yuma, like around the Mitre Lake area. Any sightings from Mitre Lake, I guess, we're probably not too concerned with, but we're still trying to document how far it spread up and down the river.
That's something a lot of experts worry about. Robert Reed is the branch chief for invasive species science at the Fort Collins Center of the U.S. Geological Survey. Reed traveled from his office in Colorado to the Yuma area for a 10-week study of the snakes. He wants to know about the potential impact they could have on the Colorado River ecosystem.
I think it's likely that they will spread. I think the spread will be fairly slow to the north, just because the Colorado River becomes channelized and doesn't have as much good habitat. I think that'll slow them, but it won't stop them.
How far the snakes may spread south is another issue.
I am concerned about their spread south in Mexico and then into the Colorado River Delta. I think that they're probably in the lower Colorado River to stay unless we develop some sort of a technological silver bullet for controlling that species. Thus far, those silver bullets have proved to be elusive for pretty much all invasive snakes.
To try to slow the spread of the southern banded water snake, Game and Fish intends to conduct local trapping efforts in high conservation areas. Officials encourage local residents to report any sightings. For the Arizona Science Desk, I'm Maya Springhawk Robnett.
A team of scientists led by researchers at ASU is hoping to get the go-ahead from NASA to fly a mission to an asteroid called Psyche. But this is no ordinary asteroid. Scientists think it could help explain a lot about our own planet. Lindy Elkins-Tanton is leading this team. She's director of ASU's School of Earth and Space Exploration, and she joins me via Skype. So, Lindy, tell me about this mission you're hoping to fly to a place that sounds like could be very interesting and insightful to us here on Earth.
I think so. We started off trying to design a mission that would help us understand how rocky, habitable planets form, planets like the Earth. And we ended up focusing on this object called Psyche that orbits between Mars and Jupiter. And we're pretty sure that it's made entirely of metal. And it's the only fairly large, more or less spherical metal object in our solar system. It would be the first metal world that humankind would ever have visited. You know, we've visited rocky and gas and ice planets, but never a metal world. And we think that it's the metal core of a little planet that started to form early in our solar system. And instead of being added to the growing planets like Earth, Mars, Mercury, and Venus through collisions, instead the collisions actually knocked the rocky outside off of it, leaving the core naked, so that we can see it and visit it. So it's the only metal core that humankind can visit. It's the only one in the solar system. And we're really excited to, we hope, go and orbit it for 20 months and learn what it really is.
So it sounds like this would give you the chance to really get a look at something you can't see anywhere else. It would be like trying to study an apple core with having the peel and the flesh of the apple already taken off.
Yes, yes. That's a perfect analogy. Our core is 3,000 kilometers beneath us, and the deepest we've ever drilled into the Earth is 12 kilometers. That's not very far when you have God. That far to go, and that pressure at the surface of our core of the Earth is 3 million times the surface pressure, and the temperature is almost 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So we are never ever going to the Earth's core. So this is the only core we could ever look at.
Was Psyche something that you already knew about when you were hoping to get this kind of information, or was it something that you just sort of found along the way?
For me, I'd heard that there was an asteroid named Psyche, but I didn't know anything about it. And after we decided the science questions we were hoping to answer, then we started searching for the target that would help us answer them. And we had several months of very exciting conversations about potential targets. This was over 5 years ago when we first started thinking about this. And it was Bruce Bills at Jet Propulsion Laboratory who was really arguing for Psyche. And the more we learned about it, the more we realized that it was the perfect target. It was the 16th asteroid ever found back in the 19th century. And so it's been known for a long time, but only recently has it been truly demonstrated to be made of metal.
So assuming that you're able to go there and you're able to study what Psyche is all about and what it's comprised of, what does that tell us potentially about Earth, and what kind of insight does that give us?
Well, there are a number of things that we don't understand about how planets are formed that will help us understand why the Earth is habitable and help us look for planets around other stars that might be habitable.
Lindy Elkins-Tanton is director of ASU's School of Earth and Space Exploration. Her team, by the way, is one of five finalists in NASA's Discovery Program. The agency expects to pick one or two to fly. That decision is expected next week. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Sticks up! Go!
My name's William, and I'm playing underwater hockey here in Phoenix. It's a weird combination where you've got a puck that slides almost like an air hockey puck. It's gliding on the bottom of the pool.
Good push.
And you've got a short stick, so it's about a foot long. And you're diving down, you're holding your breath, you're going to the pool bottom, and just pushing this puck along.
Right out of the air there.
We're doing 3-on-3, so choose a sub.
You think you've got an opening, and then you don't see somebody coming from above you. It's way better than swimming laps, so I like being in the water and the camaraderie with a group of friends doing this wacky sport that no one's heard of.
Fix up! Go!
That's William Cleveland playing underwater hockey. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just want to drop the gloves with us, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
It's the show on 91.5. With help from our partners at The Takeaway, I'm Mark Brody. The nation's urban resilience is astonishing. Many cities across the country are building smarter and stronger communities. In San Diego, for example, the city's deepwater cargo port is looking for a bigger slice of the international import-export game. Now, expansion brings more jobs and a boost to the economy, but it's about more than just cargo. Nearby neighbors worry more business means more pollution. KPBS's Eric Anderson reports.
In many ways, San Diego's Barrio Logan neighborhood is a study in contrast. Chicano Park, one of the landmarks of Barrio Logan, is a park that's located underneath an overpass. Incomes here are only half what they are in neighboring San Diego. And a few hundred yards from here, a huge industrial marine complex is separated from houses by, in some places, just a chain link fence.
A ship comes in, they either load or unload cargo, and then that cargo is delivered to its final destination.
Joel Valenzuela is the terminal cargo manager. On this day, a Dole cargo ship is using one of the terminal's 8 berths to bring in fresh fruit. The company moves more than 2 billion bananas a year through this facility. Product is lifted off the tethered vessel, then moved around a long warehouse to Dole's 300,000-square-foot refrigerated facility. There, the fruit is processed and stored until trucks move it to markets around the country.
We are a specialty port, which means we don't process containerized cargoes in large volumes like the big ports of LA, Long Beach, and Oakland. We process things that are not in containers.
That includes things like heavy industrial equipment and cement. But Valenzuela thinks the port can do more. He's standing in front of 2 long warehouses that were built originally to store cotton and animal skins. The buildings crowd the pier. Valenzuela says tear them down, and the terminal gets a lot more open space. Port President and CEO Randa Coniglio says the warehouses get in the way.
Right now, Dole needs to move those containers off that ship and then around one side or the other of this building in order to get it to the cold storage where they process the cargo. So if the building were gone, they'd have a direct shot and be able to conduct their operations faster.
And in the shipping industry, time is money. Opening up space and making the stops more efficient could boost the amount of cargo moving through the 10th Avenue terminal. There's hope the renovation could quadruple deliveries over time, and that means a lot more money for the port.
Increasing the throughput, which creates more jobs and more economic impact for the region.
But increasing the amount of cargo coming through the 10th Avenue terminal is also increasing the amount of truck traffic moving in and out of the facility. For Barrio Logan resident Eric Ortega, that means more pollution in his neighborhood.
We expected more traffic, more pollution, and it's hard to find a way to not to stop, but to let them know the people, they don't know Barrio Logan the way we live here and how our people getting sick.
Ortega and his wife Alexia currently live in a modest home just a half block away from the busy Cesar Chavez Parkway. They were fixing breakfast in their cramped kitchen on a recent morning. Alexia Ortega says the 20,000 people in their neighborhood already suffer from pollution generated at the port and other industrial sites.
I have a lungs like if I've been smoking all my life.
There was one point where Ortega got so sick from pollution that it took 6 months of medical care for her congested lungs to recover.
And finally, I cut my lungs clean, but they told me when I'm going to be old, I'm going to be carrying that oxygen because that issue that I have on my health.
That's not the future she wants for her son, who shares the family's Barrio Logan home.
Bye. God bless you. Love you.
Community activists have reached out to the port to make sure that the 10th Avenue Marine Terminal modernization will include protection for area residents. Joy Williams works for the Environmental Health Coalition. She says the port is working with the community to mitigate the impact.
We're talking about adding additional pollution to a community that's already impacted and already at high risk.
Williams was hopeful the port would help come up with solutions. She says there are easy things like rerouting truck traffic, and there are long-term solutions that will control or even reduce pollution at the terminal.
Where we see terminals going into the future is increasingly electrified and away from diesel. And that's, you know, a good trend, and we're pushing our port to go further and faster in that direction.
The Port of San Diego took a step in that direction. Months of negotiations with community activists resulted in approval of an expansion plan that includes pollution-reducing equipment and other strategies. Port Commissioner Rafael Castellanos called it a significant day for the port.
To be able to advance a project where we're promoting green technology, protecting our air, and creating jobs, it really means a lot to me. I think this is a very important day at the port. I'm very proud of what we have accomplished.
Community advocates call the deal a good beginning. They'll continue to work with the port to make sure that Barrio Logan's elementary school gets an air filtration system that'll keep pollutants out of the classroom. And advocates are pushing for a spot on a community advisory board so other port projects get the same scrutiny. I'm Eric Anderson in San Diego.
And that report comes to us from our partners at The Takeaway. You're listening to the show on 91.5. The program, by the way, moving to 9 o'clock in the morning beginning on Monday. Hope you'll join us at the new time next week. The website 538 wanted to know which American city has the most unpredictable weather. So, as it tends to do, it created a model, crunched a bunch of numbers, and came up with an answer. Rapid City, South Dakota. That's based on temperatures, precipitation, and severe weather. As for Phoenix, perhaps not surprisingly, it was deemed to have some of the most predictable weather in the country. In fact, only LA, San Diego, and Honolulu were more predictable. The data are from 2014, but we still wanted to get a Valley meteorologist's perspective on them. So we called on Ken Waters. He's warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Phoenix. And Ken, what's your take on this data?
Well, there is a point to it. In a way, it's the subject is probably maybe not the best description of it, because it's really not so much a matter of predictability, but rather variability in the climatology, because that's kind of what the real focus here is. Granted, we're one of the more, I guess I would say, non-changing climates. I mean, we know it's going to be hot in the summertime. Very hot often, and we know it's going to be Chamber of Commerce weather usually in March, so it goes along with that.
Does it help also that the severe weather we tend to have, namely the monsoons, like we basically know when they're coming, right?
We do. There's certainly a large variability there, though, and we see it year to year, we see it day to day, and we see it hour to hour, and geographically as well. Every monsoon season is different here.
Is it different in Phoenix as opposed to other places where you have maybe blizzards or tornadoes? Like, is there more variability within the kind of severe weather we can have here than in other places?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a big variety, and this study kind of shows that. The weather is more, I want to say freakish, if you will, if that's a good term, in some of the other parts of the country, especially like in the Midwest.
Yeah, there's that old saying about New England, like if you don't like the weather in New England, just wait a minute, it'll change. That doesn't really seem to be the case here. On most days, you pretty much know what you're going to get.
Yeah, and when you look at it statistically and, you add up the days, of course, it's a more stable type weather pattern here, most of the time. So as you say, a monsoon season, we're all familiar with it. Yes, it can be chaotic, but we all know it's going to be warm, it's going to be humid. Just like the springtime, most of the time, if you look at it statistically, you add up out of 100 days in the spring, 95, 96, 97 of them are going to be very, very nice. It's those other 2 or 3% that sometimes kind of throw a monkey wrench into the system.
Well, as a meteorologist in Phoenix, does it kind of bug you when people say, oh, the weather here is so predictable? Like, it almost means like you have to justify your existence.
Yeah, exactly. And granted, a lot of those days, yes, it is very easy. And that's why with this study, Phoenix comes out as one of the top, quote unquote, most predictable locations. But as a meteorologist, our challenge is not trying to come up with that temperature on a nice, fine day. Our challenge is dealing with those other 2 or 3%. And that's when everything kind of gets thrown out. It's part of what makes it challenging and makes it enjoyable to be a meteorologist.
So have you called your colleagues in San Diego and said, look, we have a much more exciting job than you have over there?
Yeah. I guess we're kind of lumped into the same category, San Diego and Honolulu, a place
yes.
I used to live at. And
you've hit all the hot spots then.
That's right.
Ken Waters is warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Phoenix, one of the more, according to 538, at least predictable weather cities in the country. Ken, thanks as always.
Thank you. My pleasure, Mark.
While the holidays are a joyous time for many people, let's be real. Sometimes getting together with your family means dealing with well-meaning, though often intrusive questions or advice to you about your personal life, especially if your family really wants you to get married.
Beta, when are you going to get married?
You know, the later you show up to a restaurant, the more limited the menu.
Raja, you're killing us.
Do you want us to die without the grandchildren?
You know, Champa, I don't even think he wants to get married. Don't do what Geeta did to us.
You and your sister can't live together forever.
Actor Ravi Patel, who you may have seen in the TV shows Master of None or It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, found himself in that situation, though not just around the holidays. With all the pressure, he decided to try the kinds of methods that worked for his parents a generation ago back in India. His sister Geeta Patel documented the entire process in a film called Meet the Patels, which just premiered on PBS's Independent Lens. NKJZZ's Sarah Ventry spoke with Ravi and Geeta Patel about this.
Hello.
That's Geeta and Ravi, and you'll hear from them, and you'll also hear clips from their movie.
Story starts 2 years ago. I had just broken up with Audrey, and I was miserable. We'd been together for 2 years, and I had never told Mom and Dad about her. In fact, they were freaking out because, you know, here I was, almost 30, never married, which in our culture is like...
Code red.
Code red. And to make things worse, 2 weeks after this breakup, I had to go on our annual family trip to India.
Just to recap, Ravi had never actually told his parents about his white girlfriend, who he had dated for 2 years. And that's largely because his parents really wanted him to marry not just an Indian girl, but someone with the last name Patel. And to clarify, not all Patels are related. Having that name just means your family is from a certain part of India. So Ravi has a conversation with his dad, and his dad tells him,
"We have a way of finding these Patel girls. And you go on these dates and, you know, we'll try not to be too involved," which, by the way, was a complete lie. and that's what happened.
So Ravi goes for it.
I guess I had this realization that whenever in my head I imagined who it was that I was going to marry, it was this Indian girl. Yet here I was almost 30 and I hadn't found one yet. And I started doing the math. I mean, when we were in India, it's like looking around, there's Indians everywhere. Those guys have it easy. But I live in America, and here I am looking for an Indian girl who's Gujarati and Patel, more
and
specifically.
And single.
And female, by the way. And all these other normal things that people look for, cute, smart, funny.
And she has to love you.
She has to love me. I have to love her. We have to find each other. I mean, there's a lot of odds stacked against me.
Right.
And then here Dad was saying, "Trust me, this is going to work."
And the whole time, Ravi's sister Geeta is documenting this. She goes on dates with him. She asks him tough questions about his feelings. And I asked her if she had ever been through the same process.
It was something that had just completely been traumatic for me. You know, I had been fighting with my parents or fighting the idea for so long that it's the last thing I wanted to make a documentary on. It's the last thing I wanted to think about. But when Ravi started making me laugh, honestly, about it, and he started really kind of getting into it and put himself into the position, I saw an opportunity, because I think growing up, there, it wasn't like I was absolutely like, no, I don't want to do this. I was torn, and it was hard to explain why I was torn to any of my American friends, because to them it was very black and white. It's like, oh, that's so weird. Of course you're not going to do that. And oh my God, how dare people think that you should do that? And I can't, are they going to arrange your marriage? That's not really what it's like. There is a very strong sense of family in this process. But also, I think the funny thing is, there's a great deal of romance in it. There's a great deal of safety. There's a great deal of, this person's going to be with you forever, and you're going to work out all your problems. You know, in a time when there's such a high divorce rate in America, Ravi and I realized very quickly that it was important to shed light on the beauty of this system and the success rate of the system. And we didn't think anyone really understood that. So that's why I think I ended up making the documentary after I had been through it and it had been so difficult for me. It was a really funny thing that I still felt so proud of it.
I guess I'm wondering, do you feel like that feeling or that sort of experience of there's this pressure from your parents to get married and have kids, and it's something that you want to do, and it's like a difficult thing to do. Is that a culturally specific experience, or do you feel like that's kind of something that's a little more universal?
Yeah, you know, the reason this film has spoken to so many people across the country is we have a lot of conservative families out there. We have a lot of people who have grown up with this idea from watching the movies that, you know, finding love and being married, it means you, that's the end of your story. That is your happy ending. Especially women. Why is it in stories of men particularly, their stories can end with starting a big company or winning a war or, you know, doing something with their lives, and along the way they fall in love. But with women, we have more stories about women ending their lives in success by finding love. And it's not that that's the truth. It's that that's the truth we have created. That is the story that we have told for generations and generations. And the Indian culture is, you know, one of the flags of this idea that when, you know, you are not successful in life until you have gotten married and had kids by a certain age. A lot of people can relate to that, as you probably know. Like, you know, a lot of people just who come from families like that.
The process of documenting this was cathartic for Geeta, and the process for Ravi was involved. There's not just one method of setting someone up. Sure, your parents could introduce you to someone they know, or the daughter of a friend, or a friend of a friend, or a relative, but there's more to it than that.
I think it's important for the audience to understand, who hasn't seen the movie, to know that one of the premises of this film is my incompetence in dating and meeting women. You're welcome, everyone. It's apparently hilarious. Then I'm going to wedding season, and, you know, my parents are coaching me from the sidelines how to pick up chicks. And then, you know, it all kind of culminated with me being at this thing called the Patel Convention.
That's right, the Patel Convention. It's where a whole bunch of Patels get together and meet. They have activities, they do icebreakers, and the goal is for people to match up. There's another system called biodata, where your family essentially makes a resume showcasing you that they can exchange with other Patels. And then there's wedding season. This is the time of year that many people get married in India, and you see the Patel family going to wedding after wedding. And at one point, Ravi's parents decide they want to set him up with a girl who is at this wedding, and they kind of pull him aside to talk about it.
You meet, you talk. If you don't like, let her go.
Yeah.
But how are we going to set it up? Let's talk about it. It's not going to happen automatically.
Yeah.
No. Do not do that. That's where you guys go too far.
Okay.
I'm telling you, I'm going to take care of it. I don't want you guys jumping and getting all these other people involved. That's when it becomes embarrassing.
We are not going to do anything you don't want us to do. Okay? It's given.
Okay, then just relax then. We're done.
When you talk to her, she may not know why you are talking to her. Don't be shy and talk to her, man.
This is the most unnecessary pep speech I've ever gotten in my life.
And you see these kinds of interactions, often funny but also poignant and sometimes difficult, between members of the Patel family throughout the film.
So, Sarah, in the end, does Ravi find someone?
I don't want to spoil it, but I can say that just as interesting as watching Ravi crisscross North America to go on dates with Patel girls is watching the family grow together throughout the process.
That's KJZZ Sarah Ventry with Ravi and Geeta Patel talking about the film Meet the Patels. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.